Welcome to PNN. The Return to the Reality Show with your host, Rob Abston. So, welcome to another episode, exciting, we hope, of PNN, the Progressive News Network. This is obviously not Rick Spezak. I'll be your guest host tonight, Rob Abston. And we're going to have some exciting guests joining us tonight. We're going to have a gentleman who has worked with he was actually recently out in Ferguson, and he's going to bring us a little bit of information about what's going on out there. He's also worked with Amnesty International, and which is what brought him to Ferguson. As a lot of you who have been watching the goings-on in Ferguson will know, Amnesty International has declared that there are civil rights violations taking place and has put the U.S. at risk for its civil rights treatment, and I think that we'll hear a little bit about that from our guest. And we have another guest who ran for Congress over on the who ran for the state legislature over on the West Coast, and she'll be telling us a little bit about her experiences running in the primary. And then we have a third guest coming in tonight who is very active over on the Treasure Coast of Florida, who is going to be telling us a little bit about the interesting things that are taking place there, about the progressive movement and its growth in the recent future. Our guest is associated with the Treasure Coast Progressive Alliance, a relatively new organization, but that has is working currently with a group that has been in chartered for some time, the Space Coast Progressive Alliance. So I think it's going to be an interesting show tonight. We've got a broad range of topics to discuss. And at some point, hopefully we'll get an opportunity to talk about what's some other issues that are going on in Florida, specifically with the election and the fact that we have the opportunity to finally replace the current governor, who is not a friend of the middle class, Rick Scott, who came in promising jobs and then pivoted, and as soon as he got in, turned those promises of jobs into tax cuts for his wealthy buddies. So a lot of things going on in the show tonight. Our first guest that will be joining us, Mohammed. Let me see if I can't dig up Mohammed's last name here. A good friend of the progressive movement in Florida, again working with Amnesty International, and who is giving up his time to help move this progressive movement forward. So he'll be joining us in just a couple of minutes. And then in the second hour, we'll be joined by Shauna Vercher, who, again, ran for the state legislature. And let's see, I think we can bring on Mohammed Malik here in just a moment. Again, Mohammed is going to talk to us tonight about the goings-on in Ferguson. For those of you who haven't been paying attention, and I think probably most of us in the progressive movement have, Michael Brown, I believe it was shot for not stepping up onto the sidewalk when he was asked to by a policeman, shot and killed. Subsequent to his murder by this policeman, he was then demonized in the media. The police released a video that they claimed was showing Michael Brown robbing a convenience store, but the convenience store owner unfortunately notified the media and let them know that in fact he wasn't robbing the convenience store at all. And so we don't really know the whole story about what's going on in Ferguson. We hope to get some news about that from our guest tonight. And the other really, I guess in my mind, the issue of concern that's taking place in Ferguson, not that the threat of your child being murdered by the police is not a serious threat, but in addition to that, we have the police showing up on the street with tanks and militarizing the streets of America. So I think we've got a lot of issues to be concerned about as progressives, and I'm happy to have somebody who can shed some light on those issues of concern with us tonight. Again, Mohammed Malik, who works with Amnesty International. Are you with us here, Mohammed?
Hi, how you doing?
I'm doing well. Are you doing well tonight?
Yes, I am.
I guess you're back in Florida from your visit to Ferguson, Missouri, and probably have some news that you'd like to share with us about that experience.
Yes. So I was on Amnesty International's human rights delegation to Ferguson. And this was about, a few weeks back, just actually like about a week after, the police killing of Mike Brown. And, I was there for, a few days, and as part of being on the human rights delegation there, it was a 13-member delegation, we sought to just try to get a sense of what the residents were going through, to meet with various kind of community partners there on the ground. And actually, again, just try to get a sense of what's happening. It tends to be unusual for some folks when they hear that, an international human rights organization was there. But given what I had seen and given what has been reported in terms of the, militarized police response and in terms of the tear gas and in terms of, the crackdown that you saw in the protesters through social media, mainstream media even, it was definitely quite a sight, and it definitely was something that I think speaks volumes about numerous issues that have been impacting cities across the United States. And I think, Mike Brown in Ferguson really has become a symbol of various issues that we've yet to deal with adequately.
You know, I was just sharing with the audience before you joined us, Mohammed, that it's definitely a big concern that we're militarizing our streets, that we have tanks and the kinds of armor and goings on that we saw in Ferguson. But backing up from that a minute, here's a young man. I don't know how old Michael Brown was, but he wasn't an old white guy like me, a fat old white guy, by the way. I think he was a young man, and it seems pretty distressing to me, if I were a parent, to think that my children would be at risk walking down the street and that they could be murdered just for not getting up on the sidewalk as soon as the policeman asked me. Do you see some relationship between that and maybe what went on with Trayvon Martin down in Sanford, Florida?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think that, one of the things that we heard was, that Ferguson, kind of represented a major, kind of focus again on the devaluation of black and brown lives in the United States. However, definitely, though, African Americans are disproportionately impacted, and that's very clear. And we should definitely acknowledge that. The thing that everyone can relate to, I think, is precisely what you just highlighted, the fact that, you know, you could be white, you can be Latino, you could be anyone. And I think if you're a parent, for example, being a parent who has a child, or being, you know, even someone who's not a parent, someone who has, for example, a little nephew or a little brother-in-law or anything like that, just as, you know, any person who values, you know, someone who's younger than themselves, the thought that you have to wonder at night, wonder in the morning, and again, you know, Mike Brown was killed, like, in the afternoon, you know, wonder in the afternoon whether, you know, someone who's younger in your family is walking down a street and can, you know, something as simple as a trip to, you know, let's say buy something from a convenience store or visit a friend or anything, who cares, right, could end up, you know, a moment of state violence in which, you know, the person that you care about is irrevocably taken from this world through state violence, tax-funded state violence, because we pay for the police officer's salaries. So definitely I think it raises a very big issue, and I think that, you know, especially as we look at, like, how, for example, there's, you know, wars abroad that are occurring that are taxpayer-funded, you have to also take a look into how our own citizens, you know, are being impacted by the state violence of being killed. And so definitely that was a major concern. I think it's definitely something that, again, as someone who cares as a family member, or quite frankly, you don't have to even have a family member, as someone who's like a, you know, citizen in your neighborhood. And when I say neighborhood, I don't mean necessarily African-American neighborhood. If you live in, let's say, for example, the state of Missouri, you don't have to even live in St. Louis or Ferguson, for that matter. You're a Missouri, you know, resident, and you hear that someone in your state was killed in such a manner, it should alarm you. If you are living in Florida, you should be alarmed that someone has killed a U.S. citizen. Even if they're not a U.S. citizen, you know, we should just be concerned that a human being has been, you know, irrevocably taken from this world. So I think, you know, in that sense, I think that this you know, Ferguson has sparked a conversation that whether you're white, you're black, or you're Latino, definitely if you're progressive, or actually you don't have to be progressive, you just have to be a human being, right? It's something that we have to think very deeply about. When these bullets are being turned on people in our own territory and their lives are being taken away, and we're funding that with our tax dollars, we have to take a very long pause, deeply reflect on the fact that something is deeply wrong, systemically, not like an individual, you know, like an individual kind of thing, but some kind of incident that happened, because there's many things that happen all the time across the country. But it requires us all to sort of stop and pause and think about this, reflect on it, and I think about the action that we need to take in order to make sure that people in our territory in the United States are not killed.
I think you're so making a really good point. I think you're making a really good point there, Muhammad. You mentioned specifically that this isn't just like an isolated incident.
Right.
Just like Trayvon Martin wasn't an isolated incident, and just like the gentleman in New York that was put into a stranglehold and had a heart attack and mm-hmm. died 3 or 4 weeks ago wasn't an isolated incident. That this is, I think what you're saying, correct me, you know, if I'm off target here, but I think what you're saying mm-hmm. is that we have a culture in our police department, a culture of lack of respect or lack of what do the right to lifers say about appreciation for every life. It seems like some lives are valued more than others. We have a lot of respect for the life of a wealthy white man who is a businessman mm-hmm. who's going back and forth to his job, but does that, you know, that when we get into the police departments at the local level, do they see every human being that they are supposed to be serving and protecting as equal to that white businessman going to his job. And I shouldn't paint it in racial terms. You know, you're with Amnesty International, and you can probably take a more global view to this. You know, that it may be just if you're poverty stricken. It may not necessarily be a white black thing. But if you're from the slums, your life may not be as valuable as the guy who is on his way to work, who is a businessman, and who the police think that that's who they're serving and working for.
Yeah, absolutely. I think there definitely is that perspective as well. I mean, let's be real. The fact is that, you know, when I was there, and you know, I have, you know, friends who live around that area right now, and the thing is that certainly poverty is a problem. Certainly, you know, it goes well beyond just, you know, young people who are specifically targeted, African Americans are specifically targeted. There's also, like you mentioned, there is the dimension of their socioeconomic background. So absolutely, what you highlight, I think, is absolutely true. You know, and this is something that we saw, again, around Trayvon Martin. It was an observation. Not surprising, it is very clearly obvious that, you know, if we were talking about a white business person, or if we're talking about, you know, a young black kid, that it would be a difference in the way that we'd see responses in media and we'd see responses by the state. And I think that highlights the particular, you know, really heinous kind of aspect of this whole thing, because we're a country that has a history of racial problems. We're a country that has that is currently steeped in a huge debate around income inequality. And so for those two things to kind of, you know, interplay in this entire conversation, I think that's part of the reason why, you know, you're seeing Ferguson being elevated to a national level. So I would say, like, in terms of the conversation about race, I think one of the things that's clearly important is to recognize that there is a relationship between race and socioeconomic background. People who are poor are disproportionately African American and Latino, right? And so, you know, all those different kinds of factors play a role into, like, what we're seeing, not just in Trayvon Martin, not just in Ferguson, but just across the country. Now, in terms of the police force, in terms of what the problem is, I would say, you know, more broadly speaking, you know, it is not only just specific types of policies, specific lack of accountability in our structures and policies, but I also think it's a culture of violence. This is, you know, whether we're talking about gun violence or we're talking about police brutality, the fact that we see so much violence being committed within our own territory in the United States, I think we need to take a deeper look into that as well. And so I think there is a culture of violence, and I think poverty does play a role. We have to also recognize that when we talk about people who are targeted by state violence in the United States, there's not just a race and a class component to that. Too often we also overlook the fact that there are many people who are, you know, who have, you know, children with disabilities, autism, people who have Down syndrome, for example. There are many women who are also targeted, particularly domestic violence survivors. And again, a lot of these things go back to some of the systemic problems that not just like our country, but many countries around the world are struggling to address. But I think given the fact that we are the richest country, we have so much resources, I just think it's obvious to say that, you know, we should expect much more from our country in terms of making progress on all fronts to make sure that people who are marginalized are not targeted.
You know, we hold ourselves up as the leaders of the free world, and I think you make a valid point. We should expect more of ourselves than maybe some other, like, third world countries. You've been working with Amnesty International, and I guess you've been to Gaza too, and maybe have some other global insights into how we stack up. I mean, do you think that it's fair that we can claim ourselves to be the leader of the free world in terms of human rights and the kinds of things that you've been working on?
Well, first of all, I mean, just to clarify, I haven't been to Gaza, but I have, you know, been, you know, watching what's happening very closely, like in Gaza, and have been very involved in the conversation around that. And what I have to say is that, you know, once again, in terms of, you know, how Gazans have faced collective punishment, in terms of, you know, the various human rights violations, it's something that is definitely deeply troubling. And I think that, you know, as Americans, we need to see this quote-unquote flashpoint around Gaza, especially the floods, mainstream media, you know, our television screens. We need to think more deeply, just as we need to think more deeply about race and the culture of violence and the United States when we think about Ferguson. We need to think very deeply about foreign policy, and we need to think very deeply about, you know, as ordinary citizens, what is our role in terms of pushing forward human rights. And so I think when we think about Gaza, we should think about, you know, when we see human rights violations, you know, what kind of policies do we want the United States to stand by? Do we want the United States to stand by a policy of, you know, making sure we call out all human rights violations and stand in solidarity? When these violations occur, we stand in solidarity with the oppressor. Are we going to, you know, simply ignore that and feed into propaganda? So I think, you know, and I don't speak as an Amnesty International representative on this particular issue because I've been active as Amnesty International on this. But more personally, I think, you know, we need to reconsider U.S. foreign aid. We need to consider that if we're going to give foreign aid to Israel or any country, you can call that any country in the Arab world, any country anywhere, we need to consider the human rights record. We need to consider whether, you know, when we give the money, what is it going to be? Is it going to promote social behaviors? Is it going to promote, or is it going to promote destruction? Is it going to promote human rights violations? I think in the case of Israel personally, my personal opinion, that clearly when we give the U.S. aid, it clearly undermines any kind of reputation the United States, positive reputation the United States wants to have in the world, particularly like in the Middle East and the Muslim world. What I would say about Gaza is that even though there's a so-called ceasefire that's been established, the fact of the matter is that Gaza remains under siege. And the poverty rate on the number of kind of like economic, social, and political impacts that Gaza faces every day is absolutely appalling. So I think, you know, hopefully what we'll see is more people who are progressive reconsidering U.S. stance toward Israel and recognizing that, you know, not all critiques of Israel should be equated with anti-Semitism and that sometimes even the use of the term anti-Semitism, while it's a very clear reality, by the way, it sometimes really uses a political tool to squash dissent. And so I know that may be controversial for some to hear me say, but I think it's also very important to say that as well, because when I've traveled to Europe and even when I've watched Israeli media, I find it shocking and sad, as someone who's American, who's born here, as an American citizen, to see that too often the coverage in Europe and even in Israel itself is actually much more accurate than the coverage that we see in the United States.
I've been seeing a lot of feedback in the media, Mohammed, about the idea, the notion that it is so taboo to criticize Israel that if you say something that you have an opinion that is contrary to what
right.
The Israeli government is promoting, that you will immediately be under siege by the organizations. What are the big organization that is anti-Semitic organization for Israel? And I agree with you. You know, anti-Semitism is a real it can be a real issue, just like
Israel,
just like racial issues in the United States are real issues. It can be a genuine serious issue that needs to be. Beat down, just like racism
Absolutely.
Needs to be beat down in the United States.
Absolutely.
But having said that, not every criticism of Israel is necessarily anti-Semitic. As soon as you are no longer able to criticize somebody for bad behavior, in fact, our founding fathers even said that. They said that if they didn't allow the president of the United States to be checked and balanced, that the president's the office of the president would become the refuge for scoundrels. And
right,
so, I mean, the point is that, and I think that's what I heard you saying, is that there are legitimate criticisms of Israel that can be made. And unfortunately, in the environment that we live in today, if you make those legitimate criticisms, you will be treated as if you were an anti-Semite, or as if it were in the United States, it would be the equivalent, functional equivalent, of being a racist. And,
right, right.
And I agree with you. I have some very serious criticisms of Israel, and you know, you can call me an anti-Semite if you want. I'm absolutely not anti-Semitic. But I'm also not anti-Palestinian. I happen to,
right.
to have read Menachem Begin's autobiography, and one of the things that Menachem Begin points out is that in his early childhood, when he first migrated from Poland to Israel, that the Palestinians had been promised a homeland at the same time that the Israelis had been promised a homeland. The Israeli got their homeland in 1947, and the Palestinians are still waiting.
Right, and I think the other thing we need to reconsider is also that, again, you know, when we don't address race, when we don't address the socioeconomic status, you know, how these things play a role in Ferguson and the streets across the United States, when we don't address, you know, for example, U.S. foreign policy for Israel and also other countries as well, when we don't address that, I think one of the problems that we create is we kind of step away from affirming a stance for our communities across the country that stands firmly with human rights. And I think that, you know, one of the things that's really important to highlight is that as we approach, for example, you know, in a couple of decades, probably less, maybe in a couple of decades, as we approach kind of like this demographic shift in this country, we have to make sure that we have very serious conversations about race, class, foreign policy, all these issues, and really consider them bread and butter issues that we talk more about, in addition to the economy, how people are suffering through income inequality. We have to address these issues as well because we have to make sure that, you know, we can establish a genuine, authentic harmony between white, black, Latino, Asian. We have to consider the various identities and issues and problems that various kind of immigrant groups are experiencing disproportionately. We also have to consider our impact on the world. And this is just you know, what this means is a truly globally conscious and responsible citizenship, right? We need to consider ourselves as Americans and recognize that our state has an impact not just on communities that too often are not heard inside our territory, but also in territories across the world, and really understand that because the United States is so powerful, we have a unique responsibility in the world as citizens to really discuss these matters more deeply and to make sure that if we have the goal of having harmony, if we have the goal of having peace, that we have to seriously reconsider the old ways of doing things and perhaps do new things. So, for example, we talk about anti-Semitism, and we also talk about the rise of Islamophobia. You know, we're approaching 9/11. In the past, I've done, you know, these workshops with Jewish folks in our community in South Florida called Combating Islamophobia and Anti-Semitism Together, right? Bringing Jewish people together, bringing Muslims together to talk about how do we actually, with principles such as peace and justice, how do we address these kind of biases within each of our communities, but also the same common goal of making sure that we can address income inequality, we can address unjust foreign policy, we can address racism, but do it in the fashion that requires critiquing within our own communities, but also requires that we lock arms and critique the larger forces that are affecting all of our communities, right? And so I think when we talk about Ferguson, you know, it's not just about, you know, police accountability. It's about looking at the larger picture and realizing if we want to live in a harmonious community where we can truly prosper, we're going to have to think and try to imagine how, given like how these policies are in economics and race and all the education, all these things, how they disproportionately impact immigrants and African Americans and other folks, how can we truly have conversations? What kind of actions should we take? What kind of campaigns should we devise that can take us closer to the vision of a country that's more united, that's more just, rather than a country that's more polarized? which is the country I think we live in right now.
You mentioned that we should stop and consider what our role or responsibility is in
right.
these broader issues, Mohammed. And I don't know if we ever have any conservative listeners to this show. I tend to suspect that we get mostly people who agree with us, progressives. But if we happen to have some conservative listeners listening, I would point out that Edmund Burke, who is considered to be or is regarded as the father of modern conservatism, is famous for having said that all that is necessary for evil to prevail is for good men to do nothing. So, and also I think we had a quote from a priest during World War II, Moeller, or I always get the name wrong, but who said basically when they came for the socialists, I did nothing because I wasn't a socialist. When they came for the Catholics, I did nothing because I wasn't a Catholic. When they came for the Jews, I did nothing because I wasn't a Jew. When they came for me, there was nobody left.
All out of luck.
So, exactly. So, you know, it's easy for us to sit back and say, well, you know, we're not Palestinian. We're not black. We're not, you know, whatever the current bias is killing the children of mothers is, and to say why should we care, but you know we don't have that option, that luxury. I think we each have a responsibility, and I'm pretty just amazed just talking with you about how much you've done and how much you have worked in causes that you believe in, and I'm pretty sure that this isn't a job that you're getting paid for. Could you talk a little bit about how you came to feel so strongly that you are willing to invest your time and working towards these causes that may or may not necessarily directly affect you?
Yeah, well, I mean, I think that, you know, in terms of, like, you know, I'm not paid to do these kinds of work. This is stuff that I do as a citizen. I volunteer my time at night, just like I'm on the call right now. I became very impassioned about race and economics and all these things because, you know, I've experienced unemployment. You know, I've experienced racism. I've also experienced what it means, you know, although I grew up in a city in Miami, I also spent some time living mostly around mostly, you know, white individuals. I was in Georgia for 4 years. And so I got to talk to people who are conservative, who are white in Georgia. I got to meet people who are from all different kinds of backgrounds. And what became clear to me is that, you know, in every place where you can go, there will be some form of marginalized group. Having experienced being that type of person in certain contexts, I'd also seen how, you know, someone could be white and they could be, you know, LGBT and they could be marginalized. So I saw how someone could be, you know, rich, but they're black and they'll be racially profiled by police, right? And I saw, like, how, you know, the kinds of oppression that we see in reality become very complex, and they kind of rupture our stereotypes. So I think, you know, I became very involved because I realized that there wasn't a lot of people doing anything, and I decided that, you know, we have to do something about this. And so I began at a very early age to get involved on multiple issues, you know, involving poverty and race and all these things, because I see them as connected. I don't necessarily see myself as wedded to a campaign for, let's say, for example, raising the wage or just a campaign for racial equality. I see myself more as an individual spiritually connected to, you know, this proposition that we can live in a society where human rights are fundamentally respected and there are protections and will be viewed as a security threat to our community and will be treated as such with that level of seriousness. So that's kind of how I got involved. I mean, it really was just through personal experience, but it was also through meeting a lot of different kinds of people, people who are not like myself. And, you know, some of them were white, some of them were black, some of them were Latino, some of them were conservative. it didn't really matter. I think the fact that I saw how there were all sorts of people who felt marginalized, all sorts of people who didn't feel protected, I think kind of gave me an awareness about why, you know, we need to, you know, commit our lives to making sure that that's not, you know, we have protection so that it can no longer be the case.
So when did you start with Amnesty International, Mohammed?
I really began as a student activist. I started with Amnesty maybe when I was in, you know, 2004, 2005, I became a member, and I was a student at that time at Florida International University. And so I got involved through that. I was founding a chapter, but I was the president of the chapter. And through that experience, I think I got a lot of exposure to lots of different kinds of groups and individuals, and I got to learn a lot about what's going on in different parts of the world. I did travel, too, as well. And so I did get to get some perspective on the various kinds of issues that people are dealing with. And so that's how I got involved in Amnesty. And through the years, I've been, you know, I was involved with the Guantanamo campaign and recently was just kind of called upon to help out with Ferguson. But that's how I got involved, and I continue to be involved. And I definitely encourage people to check out the campaign.
So you talked about we need you pointed out that we need to consider what our role is and the kinds of things that we could do. Let's just suppose that I'm a listener to the show tonight, and I'm inspired by what I'm hearing, and I'm thinking, yeah, you know, I understand. We've got this stuff going on in Florida. Trayvon Martin's still hanging out there. There's never been any resolution. Zimmerman is still, you know, running around being Zimmerman, and I'm not sure. I think he's got his guns taken away after assaulting some of his girlfriends. But it's ongoing. We've got New York with the fellow there that was strangled.
Eric Garner.
Died. And now we see this again in Ferguson. So now I'm saying, it's not maybe my problem. It's maybe I don't have a dog in this fight, but you know, we're all in this together. I need to do something. What do I do? Where do I go?
There was a famous quote by some guy who was from a long time ago. I forget what his name is, but he basically said that, you know, to paraphrase that, if you don't get involved in politics, don't worry, politics will get involved with you and will get involved with your life. I think that's actually true. And so I think even whether it's involving race or poverty or anything, and you're not personally impacted, inevitably, it's going to be splashed across your TV screen, people will be outraged, there'll be crisis in your community. You'll be impacted, right? I mean, we'll all be impacted. And so, you know, I'm South Asian, for example. You know, some people would think of, like, Trayvon Martin as a black issue. Some people would look at immigration as a Latino issue. But in reality, because we're all affected by all these things, I think the most important thing to do is to recognize that, number one. The second thing to do is to recognize that, you know, there's an obligation that all of us have. This is an obligation that some could see as spiritual, some could see as personal, out of personal conscience. It could be on different levels. But I think there's a responsibility to support people who are not like yourself in the work that they do. So, for example, there are African-American people who are organizing Ferguson, right? Majority African-American community. I think it's important for all of us to try to find ways that we can support the work that they're doing. I think when we talk about how immigrants are targeted, I think it's important for anyone who's listening to look into the community and find out who's working on trying to get dignity for immigrants, right? I think it's important to lock arms with them, you know, either financially support them or to support them by joining a campaign. And I think, you know, lastly, I think it's just really important to start conversations in your community. And I think it's incredibly important, particularly for progressives, to try to figure out how we can give more financial support, more activist support for protests, and really just reach across the kind of boundaries that we typically find ourselves. If you go to meetings in your group and they're mostly white, then I think it's important to think through, okay, well, what can we do to try to reach out and learn from other communities who we're typically not talking to. I think it's also true for other communities, too. We talk about immigration reform, you know, making sure that, for example, there's more conversations between African-American and Latino communities. When we talk about police brutality, making sure we're talking about it as an issue that impacts human beings. And I think that when we begin to think differently about that, when we begin to consider how we should support in different ways than we're accustomed to, then we begin to see how people come together in different kinds of ways. So I think, you know, one, think differently, two, act differently, and three, you know, you'll see a different kind of world.
Okay, so I've listened to this broadcast. I'm thinking differently. Maybe I've always kind of felt like, and you know, I tried to do the right thing, but I'm recognizing that maybe I've missed out, and that I'm going to try to act better. And now I want to work with other people to help make that a bigger effort. Is there a group that, if you know, I think you're in South Florida, is there a group for our friends listening from South Florida that they can contact and that they can join in with others to help cultivate kind of a culture?
Yeah.
Do you have
a link,
URL?
In South Florida, for sure, if you're in Miami area, I think there's a wonderful cluster of groups that is working together to build across race, racial lines and all these things. Power Youth, Center for Social Change, it's a great youth of color organization that's bringing together people around policing issues. And I also think the Miami Worker Center is doing great work. These two organizations in particular are bringing people together in new ways. Very inspiring. I went to one of the meetings on the board of their kind of coalition effort. So definitely look up Power U. Definitely look up Miami Worker Center. Support them if you can. Check out their work if you can. If you're in the area, you can definitely link with them to see how you can get involved. And in terms of, you know, Ferguson and showing support, one of the things when I went to Ferguson, I asked a bunch of residents, how can people, when I go back, like, how, what would you say to them if you said, you know, support? And you know, most of the residents I talked to said, you got to make sure you go back and deal with this issue because we know it's not happening just here, right? You need to go back and you need to find out, you know, what groups are involved with these policing issues. Get involved with them, throw your life into them, and let's try to make this this change national.
I think that's some pretty good advice, Mohammed. There was one other topic I think that you have some insight on. I don't know if you have a few minutes, but would you like to talk a little bit about the marijuana initiative in Florida?
I don't know too much about that. I'm not too involved in it. So I don't know if I can comment on that. I'm not active on the campaign. But I do think it's highly problematic, obviously, that so many people are being targeted and criminalized. In fact, many of them losing their right to vote because they get felony conviction due to things such as, like, marijuana possession, certain kinds of marijuana possession, right? So I think it's obviously, you know, problematic on a personal level. And I think that, obviously, we should we see public opinion really changing, not just in Florida, but across the country. And so I think it's important to also consider, you know, how is something like marijuana reform, how is that something that's important to something as fundamental as, you know, someone's ability to vote, to make sure that they're not permanently disfranchised in this state. So that's something personally I think about. I'm not particularly active in that campaign, but I would suggest that people think about what are the impacts of what impact does criminalizing marijuana have upon, you know, so many Floridians, and what does that mean for the prospect of democracy in Florida? I think it's larger than just someone's right to smoke or not smoke. I think it's larger than just a medical issue. I think it's also goes to the core of what we think about when we think about democracy.
That's a big issue, and I don't know if you are, like, tuned in to the issues with voting in Florida, with the right to vote and how that's infringed upon. I know that South Florida was one of the places where people stood in lines during the last election for, like, hours to, like, midnight, 1 o'clock in the morning in order to be able
right.
to vote. Did you experience that yourself?
Yeah, I mean, voting is we have multiple problems that impact voting rights in the state of Florida, from voter suppression to the voting lines, to disfranchising completely, people just being completely stripped of their right to vote. And I think it becomes as no coincidence and should be something that people care deeply about, because just imagine that you care about healthcare. Like, you're someone who just works your job really hard. You go home, you maybe turn on the tube sometimes, and you think about some medical problem you have, and you watch these idiotic politicians blabber on and on the news, not seeing any solution in near sight. And yet you can't really participate in that process that would help you get closer to getting, let's say, health care. Let's say even your own voting rights. Let's say, you know, you want to improve the economy in your state and you have a particular opinion about who could help do that. When you're completely locked out of the system, and yet you're told that you live in the United States of America, the freest land in the world, there's a certain kind of, like, marginalization, alienation, and frustration that causes that should totally be addressed. And I think the fact that Florida is witnessing so many demographic changes, the fact that Florida's population is increasing so quickly to the point where I believe we're soon going to be one of the top, you know, states in terms of population. We already are, but we're going to be higher in terms of population. When you look at Texas, New York, and California, we need to seriously consider, like, what that means. I also think that it also requires us to think about, you know, what is the kind of political composition of Florida? Are we a conservative state? I mean, I would argue that if we could actually have every vote counted, we might begin to question that. Are we really a conservative state? Everyone has the right to vote in Florida. How would they vote? What kind of issues become more important? What kind of participation rates do, right? So, you know, in terms of voting rights, you know, Florida faces the most challenges. And I think that, you know, we'll see in the years to come, like, the kind of efforts to beat back reactionaries to make sure that we could have some semblance of democracy in the state.
Do you think it's possible that criminalization of individuals for anything and everything, marijuana included, could
sure.
possibly be related to the idea that when less people vote, those people with the most influence and power already usually come out ahead?
Yeah, I mean, we see that in many ways, where people who are powerful and richer, people who have more access to the, you know, the political elite, will tend to have more access. And we do find that people who are disfranchised tend to be disproportionately poor. They tend to be disproportionately people of color. But let's also be realistic and say what needs to be said. The majority of people who are disfranchised are actually, they're white. There's also white people who are affected. So I think that, you know, this goes to a deeper issue. Definitely, you know, Jim Crow is well aligned. You know, we can see how some of its designs are impacting people of color in Florida and the South, in particular in many ways. I think, you know, the drug war is one great example of how we saw that, in terms of how there's been a war waged on communities of color by police. But I also think that, you know, we need to also look beyond that and also recognize that this is impacting everyone. We're all being impacted. We're all being affected by this and impacted by this, some in other ways that are worse, right, while recognizing that our entire community, our entire political health as a state is being degraded by this. And so I think, again, just when we look at Ferguson, we look at tax on voting rights and how people of color are disproportionately targeted, recognize that if you don't like the fact that your state is not progressive, recognize that it's attacking, it's this design of attacking, like, communities of color that is implicit in eroding the political health of our state, so that when you ask whether we live in a conservative state or progressive state, it's quite obvious that we don't live in a progressive state. So if we want to change that, we all have to participate in making sure that these policies that target communities of color are things that we all can work together to unravel, right? And again, this is coming from a South Asian. I'm not Latino. I'm not African American, right? And so I'm recognizing this from this kind of perspective, where I don't come from a community in this state that's particularly impacted in that kind of way, disproportionately. But I also, just looking at the numbers, having talked to so many people, realize that this is something we all have to get in on. We're going to have to lock arms and cross racial lines and class lines and make sure that we can, you know, turn what has become the mockery of voting rights in this country into hopefully the exemplar of voting rights in the United States. And I think we can do that.
So you talk about locking arms, Mohammed. We have another guest coming on who recently ran for political office and is also involved in an effort to turn Florida progressive. And when you talk about locking arms, I think what you're talking about is that joining together as a movement to say, you know, those people that are entrenched in power and who have brought us to where we are today need to let go a little bit, and it's going to depend on all of us working together to sort of put pressure on them to do that. And so, Shauna, are you with us?
I am. Thanks so much for having me.
So, Mohammed, Shauna Vercher is our next guest, who is from the west coast of Florida and who ran for state representative and is engaged in what I think you're suggesting we should all be thinking about participating in, which is the joining together as the middle class to move forward towards a more progressive future for the state of Florida specifically, but in more general terms across the country. Mohammed, it's up to you if you want to stick around a little bit and participate in the discussion. You're certainly welcome to. But I'd like for Shauna to elaborate a little bit on her efforts and how she is encouraging people to do exactly what you're proposing that they do, Mohammed.
Yeah, I was listening to some of what Mohammed had to say, and he's absolutely right in the fact that we do have a disillusionment and disenfranchisement problem with our voters right now. And, you know, there's a saying that when it comes to voting, Republicans fall in line and Democrats need to fall in love. And part of our issue as progressives tends to be that even, as Mohammed was saying, even those people that have a right to vote, that don't have any impediment to voting, they're not stepping up. They're not seeing some candidate that they believe is ideal, and so they're staying home. And one of the things that I believe progressives have to work together with different organizations around the state as well as around the country is finding those candidates that we feel like will be incrementally better in certain areas and starting to build a bench so that when it comes to these other opportunities, like we had this time with trying to unseat a very unpopular governor, we actually have someone that progressives can rally behind and be excited about. I'm not speaking ill of Governor Crist, but he's far from being someone that 4 years ago progressives would have pointed to and said, yes, that's our guy. And so I believe building a bench is part of the answer there.
Yeah, when you talk about Governor Crist, and by the way, Mohammed, are you going to be able to stick with us for a few minutes and jump in?
Yeah, I'll stick around.
When you talk about when you talk about Governor Crist 4 years ago, a couple of things jump out at me, Shauna. One of them is, and this is going to be on the plus side, I like to start out with the good things if I've got something good to say about somebody, is that Charlie Crist did extend the voting rights to convicted felons who had served their time. So I think that, you know, we have to give the man credit where it's due. One big issue that I have with Charlie Crist, and, you know, I'm a Democrat and I'm supporting him because he won the primary. So this is not about, you know, bad-mouthing somebody. But in terms of policy, I found it a little bit disturbing that he signed into law a bill to permit offshore drilling. And I'm, you know, I'm not for sure, but it happened to be just about the time that the candidate for president on the Republican ticket, John McCain, was looking for a vice presidential running mate. So, again, I'm supporting our candidate 100%, but this offshore drilling issue is something that's near and dear to my heart.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of things that, yeah, absolutely, I see what you're saying. I mean, Governor Crist has done a lot of progressive things as a Republican governor, and even in his continued role in public service, he's tended to become more of a populist. He's someone that I've spent some time with as, you know, before I ran a campaign for state representative. I've been a political correspondent and a media strategist for years, so I've spent some time with Governor Crist, and I can tell you that even though I disagree with pretty much everyone I meet on certain policy issues, we're always going to disagree on something. I can tell you he sincerely loves the state, and he's coming from a place of wanting to do the right thing. But it is difficult when your entire infrastructure and your entire career has been based about around one set of values, one set of core constituents, one set of donors, a set of advisors. You've built an entire career around that strategy and that set of core beliefs, and now he's having to make a lot of adjustments quickly. And certain things that are just acceptable on one party side are absolutely taboo on the other. And that would be the case if a Republican, if a Democrat became Republican. We see that happen on both sides. There is an adjustment period. But one of the things he's going to have to recover from is he's got to identify who he is now. He's going to have to get that message out to voters. He's going to have to assure us that he's telling something sincere and that he will stick to that. And then we've got to feel strongly enough about him that we trust him to have a second go at this. And unlike, you know, the quote-unquote value voters, we're not going to go to the polls just out of animosity. There will be a certain amount of people that say anybody but Scott. And I agree with the fact that Governor Scott has been a terrible burden on the state. But at the same time, that's not going to be enough to make him successful. And so as progressives, what can we do to rally around not just a candidate, but an idea that, like, listen, at least this guy's willing to sit down with us. At least he's willing to go to bat for certain values that I believe in, even though he's not perfect.
Well, I can tell you, I would definitely go to the polls to vote for anybody but Scott. In fact, I've been looking for the opportunity to talk a little bit about that, and I'm not sure if we'll get the time to do that tonight. But it just is very disturbing to me that the state of Florida one time elected the biggest thief in America, who was narrowly escaped prosecution for defrauding Medicare, and whose company was fined $1.7 billion. But to think that that could actually happen twice in the state of Florida, it just, I don't understand. And even my 83-year-old mother, Shauna, who has pretty much tended to vote Republican all her life, not kind of the hardcore Republican that we see coming out of the Tea Party in Florida today, but generally has tended to vote Republican, being from the Midwest. And even she said that she would absolutely never, ever vote for Rick Scott and didn't understand how he could get elected. So, if we can turn out people just on the basis of anger towards Rick Scott, I think that's going to be a wonderful thing. Now, Mohammed, I know that you know, you didn't come on the show tonight to talk about one political persuasion versus another, but you did also mention that you in terms of how we think about changing the culture and changing the behavior and changing the direction that we're headed in, that we have to make certain decisions. And I also know that you have a specific interest in the marijuana bill, or not a specific interest, but you have a position on it. How do you see, you know, the current political landscape as far as how what we decide in November is going to affect Florida's future for the next however many weeks, months, years?
Yeah, and on this, you know, I'm speaking to myself, not for any particular organization, but what I would say is that on the one hand, for sure, you know, we have to recognize that Rick Scott is nothing less than a menace to society in all ways that we can consider it, from health care to voting rights to you name it. It's pretty clear and shocking, yes, that we actually have such a corporate robot who's in office. I'll call him a corporate robot because that's what he is. But I also think that what Shauna was mentioning in some respects is very important to consider. I think that, you know, if we're progressives, we have to consider what are our values, how do we vote. And, you know, some people will vote for Chris, some people will reluctantly do so. There's different gradations of, like, how people will approach the question of who they vote for. I think what's critically important is for people to be educated about what are the issues they care about. And so that can go from, for example, driver's licenses. It'd be great to have driver's licenses for undocumented immigrants, for example. We need to make sure that all candidates are standing behind those particular asks. We need to make sure that voting rights is completely, completely respected, completely embraced as much as possible. Because again, you know, the health of democracy in the state of Florida is going to depend on how much, at minimum, we respect voting rights. Chris made some great reforms. You know, but again, there were some more that we can be pushed further. I think as progressives, we have to imagine how we can push the envelope even further than that. In terms of LGBT protections, we need to make sure that we can push those forward. In terms of, you know, the economy, you know, Chris has said that he's interested, I believe, in raising the wage. We need to not only consider how much, you know, we have to consider not just, like, raising the wage, but how much further, what other kinds of protections, what other kinds of, maybe, for example, even having a labor department for it. For God's sake, we don't even have one in the state of Florida, right? So I think, you know, some people will vote for Chris. Some people will not vote for Chris. Some people will reluctantly do so. Many people are anything but Rick Scott. There's various gradations of how people will tend to vote. But I think in the midst of doing that, that's an individual decision that people are going to make, right? People are going to come down where they're going to come down. But I also think that, you know, what's very clear is we need to think beyond the box that we're typically, you know, engaged in. We need to think about, no matter who is elected, how do we think as progressives? How do we conceive of ourselves? What kind of environment do we live in? What kind of candidates do we want to produce on a local level? What kind of candidates do we want to produce? What are our local issues? So I think, yeah, we're talking about state issues, but I also do truly believe that democracy is from the ground up. I think that school board elections, all these other kinds of things, are also really important to think about. Now, obviously, the November election is coming up, but I think that, you know, we need to carefully think about all the issues. I mean, we think about if Charlie Crist is elected, are people prepared to push him? And if he's not elected, what are people prepared to do? So I think that's what I would say. I would say that it's really just important for us to really dig deep into what our values are. And I think it's important for us to vote on our values, but also recognize that voting itself is not it's necessary, but it's not sufficient, right?
I think what I hear you saying, if I might just like condense this into a quick and easy way for an individual to act on those beliefs that you're talking about, is what we need is a scorecard. We need a way to measure up every candidate that we're voting for against those
sure.
things that are near and dear to our heart that we believe in. And in fact, we just recently had an event in Orlando to do exactly that, to prepare a progressive scorecard for this coming election. And I want to read something that I ran across recently. I wasn't aware of that there's a lawsuit that's been filed against Rick Scott. And Shauna, you might know about this too. But this Tallahassee lawyer, let's see, what's his name? I'll find the name in just a second. But he's filed a lawsuit against Rick Scott. Oh, Stephen R. Andrews. And the lawsuit, he suggests that Rick Scott is a public hazard. And I think that's what I heard both of you saying, that you see Rick Scott as a public hazard. In Stephen Andrews' case, after he filed the lawsuit, Rick Scott tried to buy the land that his office is sitting on. And just recently as September 5th, the Supreme Court of Florida ruled against Rick Scott and his cabinet and required that Google and Twitter turn over all of their records relating to the emails and tweets that have been exchanged between Rick Scott and the members of his cabinet. Have you heard about that lawsuit, Shauna?
I haven't, and I'm familiar with the violations of Sunshine Law, too, and it's not as if we haven't known that this was happening for several years. You know, the second that the Sunshine Law was examined by the current administration, they looked at it and said, how can we get around it? And it became one of those things that private email accounts, Facebook account messages, that became the norm as far as exchanging communications, even between statewide department heads and elected officials, and as well as lobbyists. And the exact reason that we have the Sunshine Law, where public is entitled to this type of information to see what type of activity their elected officials are up to, is so that people cannot circumvent and make backroom deals. And one of the biggest, you know, boondoggles of a backroom deal was the redistricting process. I mean, we knew that lobbying firms were at the table. We knew that there were statisticians and cartographers looking at how can we slant the districts. I mean, in Pinellas County, for example, we have a district with a big donut hole in the middle of it, and you have to cross the bay to get to the other piece of the district. It makes absolutely no sense. But while we know it, part of the problem is that we're not holding anyone accountable. And that goes back to building up a strong progressive infrastructure that knows where and how to mobilize most effectively. And I would say it's not just holding one side or the other accountable. We're really guilty of saying, well, if this person's on our team, maybe we shouldn't say anything negative about them because we don't want to make them vulnerable, or at least they're better than the other guy. And so what we've ended up with is a bunch of, quite frankly, mediocre Democrats in elected state positions that get away with betraying progressive values because at least they're not as bad as the other guy. And in that regard, we've got to kind of get some sort of infrastructure in place and get a little bit of boldness into this progressive infrastructure and to the progressives around the state, to where we're not scared to say this is wrong and I don't care what team jersey you're wearing, you have to uphold these values or you will pay a price. We will primary you. We will dry up your donor money. We will expose you to the media. And we're just not doing that in an organized way.
Well, I couldn't agree with you more, but I think that you're saying that in balance with what you said earlier, that we have to work incrementally, and we have to not just wait until we find a candidate that we fall in love with and vote for him. We still have to – you're not saying – I don't think you're saying that just because this one candidate isn't our progressive guy who is willing to stand up and say the right thing at the right time to the right people, even though he's not that person, it doesn't mean that we should just not vote or not participate. I think what you're saying is that – yeah, we have to get the best guy in there, even if he's not ideal. But that's not good enough. We can't stop there. We have to go further and build that bench.
Look at it like a relationship, exactly. If you look at this like a relationship, you know, you're not going to make a decision about someone, you know, whether they're compatible with you on the first date if they don't do everything 100% perfect. You know, you're going to say, well, listen, they like this show and I can't stand that show, but at least we have this in common and we might have religious disagreements, but at least we believe in the same social values. That's how we normally build relationships just culturally. But yet with our politicians and elected leaders, if they don't fit every single criteria, we're not even willing to put in the effort to kind of shape them to our values. So maybe you have a candidate that doesn't have everything that you would ever want when they're running, but you believe that they are genuine in spirit, that they have their heart in the right place, and that they would listen to you. Well, that's a start. But now that they've committed to this relationship, we need to commit to the relationship. They're in elected office, and it's like, okay, if you're going to call yourself a progressive, if you're going to need our votes, if you're going to want our donor money, then we need you to act like one. Are there going to be mistakes along the way? Absolutely. But do what we hired you to do. And that's another mindset that I wish we would shift. I mean, these people work for us. They are supposed to be public servants, and yet we're so unwilling to fire them. We're not even really willing to give them an honest performance evaluation once, you know, more than once every 2 to 4 years, and that is frightening.
I think we should also do, particularly as we talk about Trayvon Martin, as we talk about Ferguson and a bunch of other different kinds of things, I think we should also think about these state attorney races. I think we should talk about judges. I think we should talk about all these sorts of things. I mean, of course, we have an election that's imminent, right? But I also think that when we talk about being progressives, we have to also talk about when we think about police brutality or other kinds of issues that oftentimes we just think of as affecting communities of color, we have to also think about, you know, how can we as progressives affect these kind of races? Who are progressives who can run for state attorney's office? Who are progressives who could be judges? You know, even around immigration, for example. These are all things that we should also think about. But outside of the electoral system itself, I think it's, you know, voter participation is incredibly important, but political participation is important, too. I think also being active on issues around police brutality, around women's rights, around LGBT rights, all these other things are also going to be incredibly important. Building up power within campaigns and having an electoral analysis, having a strategy that is not just about moving issues, but is about, you know, moving communities, building power, all these things. Just like the civil rights movement, how they envision building power. You know, we need to also think about when we're doing things in between elections, what exactly are we doing? What are we doing to set the stage to build power so that when we talk about things like what Sean is talking about in terms of, you know, let's hold these people accountable for our values, we have something we could bring to bear that actually have more consequences than what is the case now.
That's that was the thing that I got from what Sean was saying when she was talking about building relationships, Muhammad. And I think that you nailed this. I think our next guest, John Debus, who I'm going to introduce in just a minute, is going to talk about this a little bit. But I think that's one of the biggest mistakes that we make as conservatives. We, first of all, the first mistake we make is that we don't really know, we don't pay attention enough to learn. I say we collectively, I don't mean necessarily Shauna or you, Muhammad, or me, but I mean that our general voting block. I think as a community, we don't really pay attention enough every day to really know who these people are so that when it comes time for election, we're not really well enough informed to make an informed decision. And so we get distracted by whatever the latest media buzz is and which can be manipulated. And so we don't get the opportunity to really make the best decisions we would make if we were informed. But the second thing that we don't do, and that Sean is talking about, is that we think that once we've voted, assuming that we made an educated decision, which we probably didn't, that once we've voted, we've done our job, that now it's up to that representative to do his job. And that's the reason why it is so easy for organizations like the Koch brothers to come in and drop a $3 million money bomb into somebody's district if they don't do what they tell them to do, because we don't have their back. For we spend 3 or 4 months, we meaning the voting community again, spend 3 or 4 months being courted by our elected our candidates for elected positions, and then after we vote and they get in office, we say, great, rah rah, we did our job, we got our man, and then we throw that guy out to the wolves, and for the next 2 years or 4 years, depending on what he's running for, or 6 years if it's a senator, for the rest of the time, he has to go up against all of these people with money that live 24/7 to make his life as miserable as possible because he's not their candidate. And so if anything that we can do as a progressive community, I think, and I think what I hear Shauna saying is that we need to cultivate a support community for those elected representatives that we can successfully get elected to office. And on that note, Shauna, I want you to stick around. John is going to be with us for half an hour or so here. John Debus is a member of the Treasure Coast Progressive Alliance, which is associated with the Space Coast Progressive Alliance, which has been around for a number of years. And John is doing exactly those kinds of things. John is picking up signs and going out onto I-95 and saying, you know, these are the things that are important to us. Pay attention. John, are you with us?
Yes. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can. How's the is movie night there at your progressive group?
Yeah, we're watching the movie that's in conjunction with the climate march in New York. It's kind of getting us ready for that climate march on the 21st of September up in New York, which a few of us are going up for.
All right. We lost somebody. I'm not sure who is. I think you're still with us, Shauna?
Yeah, I'm still here.
Okay. I think Mohammed had to drop off. Shauna, I know that I originally met you in the effort to turn Florida progressive, and that's an effort that John is working diligently at at a very grassroots level. And I don't know if you have worked with John in the past, but John, would you like to share a little bit about what your efforts are down there in the Fort Pierce area, in the Treasure Coast, to make a difference, to move progressive, the progressive vision forward?
Sure. We're the Treasure Coast Progressive Alliance. We kind of formed a little less than 2 years ago. We came out of the Occupy movement. And as the Occupy movement was kind of disappearing, we looked to the Space Coast Progressive Alliance, which was a good organization north of us, and we kind of copied them somewhat and started our group down here. And our group, basically what we try to do, we have monthly events where we try to educate the people. We either have speakers on progressive issues or we show documentaries. What we try to do is three things. We try to bring awareness, we try to educate, and then we try to bring activism. We continue to do some of our Occupy stuff, is going into the streets and with what we call rallies. We support, like, March Against Monsanto, and we go out by the farmers market here in Fort Pierce and try to hand out flyers and try to educate the people on Monsanto or whatever's coming up. In November, we'll be doing a march against corruption. And every month, we try to do overpass. At I-95, we have a banner with the deer fencing. I don't know if you've ever seen the Backbone campaign where they had the deer fencing with the letterings and all. And we have one for Trans-Pacific Partnership, trying to bring people aware of that. And we have one on the Keystone Pipeline. We have one on that. And we do one on of each once a month. We just go out there from late 5 p.m. to 6 p.m. just for 1 hour at the I-95, and we get a lot of support, a lot of beeping, a lot of people making awareness, and that's all we're trying to do is just try to bring awareness to issues and try to educate the people and try to get people involved.
So how many people do you have in your group there in Fort Pierce, John?
Our membership's approximately about 40-45. We have approximately 350 people on our email list. But the thing is basically just trying to get people out, trying to get people involved, which is the hardest thing. That's the key, getting people out, getting people involved, and trying to build an organization here that we can make a difference. We try to go to our city and county council meetings to try to get involved in local issues and just try to get try to make a difference along here and try to grow a movement and try to influence our politicians.
On these I-95 signs that you put up, is this like a banner that you hang down from an overpass that people can see driving down I-95?
It's on two PVC poles, and it's like deer netting across there. And we have a couple things spelled out. The Keystone one is windmills, not oil spills, stop Keystone XL pipeline. The other one is TPP, Trans-Pacific Partnership, free trade, stop the TPP. And
so what? Where do you put these? Is this like on an overpass where everybody on I-95 can see it, or is this like on an off ramp for people that live locally?
It's an overpass. We do it on Oslo Road in Vero Beach. Oslo Road overpass kind of goes over 95 and kind of dead ends, so it's kind of not much traffic down there. So we go up on the overpass. And we put up our banner so the people driving under the overpass, at the approach, they can read the banner. And we get a lot of good response.
Cool. Shauna, is this the kind of thing that you envision with the Turn Florida Progressive movement?
Well, I think awareness is absolutely critical, and then having the people that are that committed that they're taking their time to be active in this type of organization to not only become educated, but, you know, it sounds like they're also taking it upon themselves to educate people they know to try to bring in other people in the community and spread that awareness is critical. Part of the issue, though, is where is the support for an organization like this, which sounds fantastic. You know, they start to make progress on an issue, for example, and where are the, the donors, the media outlets, and the people in the within the Democratic organization to hold an elected official's feet to the fire. So once he uncovers something, let's say that's happening at a local council meeting, then he can't do it alone. And that's part of my frustration and what we're trying to establish now through the movement that we're looking to build is, okay, well, how do we provide him resources? You know, somebody's paying for those signs. And usually from what I meet, if he's anything like most of the activists I know, they end up paying out of pocket for almost everything. And activists can't be expected to stay on top of the issues, get the word out, make themselves exposed in a lot of different issues. It's not like I'm sure he hasn't ever been harassed or what have you through this. Pay for everything, and then come up with a method to actually execute change. We have to provide organizations like his with a lot of support. And at the same time, while it's a big job, most organizations that I know that have spawned from the Occupy movement would be grateful for any support or help or even acknowledgement of the work they're doing. So I think there's going to be a lot of encouragement along the way if we as progressives decide to help them out.
So, they need support. I think what you're saying is that we have a local chapter here in Fort Pierce that is kind of an island, and they need to be part of a larger network where they have the support of their peers and they have the support of a larger umbrella organization that all of their peers belong to.
No formal membership of sorts. If he had somewhere to go where he's like, listen, we are getting some traction on this issue right here. You know, like Stand Your Ground is a great example. Sanford did not expect to be in front of a national firestorm of an issue. But when that happened, where was the support that we could have provided them? You know, if he comes and he says, listen, my group is here. We have this type of credibility in our community, and we're getting traction on this issue, which is very important. Where does his funding come from? You know, who does media training to make sure that if something happens in Fort Pierce and it gets beyond, you know, the normal realm of what they're used to dealing with, that he's effective in getting as much media attention as possible? Who's going to leverage that media attention into larger membership? Who's going to provide the infrastructure to track that membership? Because he can't do it with just 30, 40 people as this thing starts to grow. So we're really good at attacking problems and trying to climb big mountains. What I feel like as progressives we're not good at doing is looking at and saying, okay, this guy's already climbing a big mountain. How do we get him some help instead of going over here and climbing my own mountain?
When you say we, who are you talking about?
I think it's the progressives that aren't willing to stand out there in the hot sun and hold the sign. You know, like we'll honk and cheer for him, but, you know, for every 20 people that he manages to get out there on a busy day, there's 200 to 2,000 people that are driving by that agree with him. well, what are they doing to help him? I mean, agreeing with him is great, and it's a start. And he's already gotten people talking about an issue that likely no one else is doing effectively. Okay, but what can we do? I'm in my car. I agree with him. What do I do now? You know, do I give money? Do I go to a website? Do I write a petition? Do I, you know, email my editor at my newspaper? A lot of good-intentioned progressives that don't have his commitment could still be doing something. And that something really adds up. And we saw that. We've seen that successful when we elected a president. You know, everybody doing what they could meant a lot. But that wouldn't have happened if we hadn't had a really great infrastructure of the presidential campaign to direct that energy into something constructive and not just allowing people like him to stand out there and hold the burden alone.
I think you just said the magic word, Shauna. Infrastructure.
Yeah. Yeah, can you hear me?
Yes, sir.
Yeah.
Yeah, she's absolutely right with and I kind of stress that in our organization that there's many people that can't get out there on the streets and all because of their jobs. Some of them might be bankers or whatever that, you know, they can't get out in the public and all, but we stress that, you know, come to our meetings, join our membership. We still can use your support, the support the people that can, and that's how we're trying to grow with each person doing whatever they can to help the cause. As far as the financing and all that stuff, we're kind of self-supporting. We're getting by. We're not getting big donations, but we're getting by and enough to buy our materials. So a lot of the materials come from the individuals. We buy our own material somewhat. But we also try to get money also to buy information. I don't know if you ever heard of the OccuCards. The OccuCards are very informed cards on all the different progressive issues with real nice pictures on the front, and it talks about all the issues on the back. And we try to get those cards and hand them out to people to educate people on the issues. And if you haven't heard of the OccuCards, maybe check them out, Google them. Very good informational type material to pass out.
So, Shauna, I heard you say that they don't, our progressives don't necessarily have to be members of something, and at the same time we need some organizational infrastructure. So would you like to elaborate on that a little bit? Is the way that we interact with our progressives, besides the fact that we're standing up on the overpass with the sign, and maybe it's got a URL that they can go to. Is it through a mailing? If it's not through membership, if we're not building infrastructure through membership, is it through email lists? Is it through?
I mean, communication is definitely important, and I don't want to undersell the value of what he's able to do with holding sign. There's a lot of organization that goes into something that seems that simple. And I guess that's kind of my point, is we're kind of taking our activists for granted, and we can't expect them to do so much more to kind of take it to the next level. They've started the ball rolling. Now who's going to pick it up and run with it from there, or help them run with it to the next step? So there's a couple of different things that I would suggest is important. There does need to be some sort of organization that, and I use organization as far as describing an entity that has an infrastructure that people know where to go, but not necessarily something that's a club, but an infrastructure where people say, you know what, we're good at A, B, C, and D, but we usually get stuck on E. Who can help us with that? And then, you know, it's about teaching a man to fish. You know, as his organization continues to grow, they're going to continue to meet whatever the next challenges are. Well, where do they go to for that assistance? We're all learning as we're going because politics is changing. At the same time, while we can't – I am opposed to saying that all organizations need to come under a formal umbrella, because that's just not how we work as progressives. And obviously they're doing something right, or they wouldn't be continuing to grow and be successful. I'm just suggesting the organization to support what they're doing. But on the other side, I do believe that there's a lack of fellowship among progressives. We all feel, I mean, you guys are on an island literally, but I would say most progressives feel like they're on an island these days. Like we're screaming to the heavens and no one is hearing us. So this sense of community and camaraderie tends to happen when we're successful at protesting an event or making an accomplishment in an electoral cycle or something along those lines. I'm suggesting also that we need some sort of fellowship that is not just in the difficult times where we reassure each other, listen, you're not the only one that feels this way. And as a state, we are very transient. A lot of us did not grow up here. We weren't born here. And so that type of fellowship is critical if even emotionally we're going to be able to support organizations like his.
So if we – okay, so we need that camaraderie and fellowship among like-minded individuals. And so we need communication and – somebody somewhere manages some mailing list that gets some communication out. And so if we don't want to call it an umbrella, what do we call it, a network? What is it that enables us to maintain that communication that joins all of these little islands with bridges? I'm trying to really pick up on exactly what the sense of the terminology is. If the
question
about umbrella organization is that it's somehow a hierarchy that sends communication one way down and there's no communication back up, then I agree with you that probably that's not a good organizational structure. But if it, what we're talking about is a network, that network has a lot of local chapters in the network, but that they have some ability to organize themselves into a higher level entity that helps to provide that communication, that helps to facilitate that communication, and helps to provide extra resources from this organization to that one when that one's making traction and vice versa. When I talk about an umbrella organization, I'm not thinking about some kind of a hierarchical structure where the top makes the decisions for the people at the grassroots. I'm really thinking more about a sort of a central exchange for the network where all of the grassroots organizations can do what you're suggesting, which is
share
resources.
Exactly. It's a combination of a network and a coalition, you know, and so part of that exchange is going to be of information and part of it's going to be of skill set. And quite frankly, as an activist myself and as someone who's been in the public eye, sometimes you don't always anticipate how big something's going to get or what new resources you might need. It doesn't make sense for every small organization or every local organization to have one of everything. We need to have consolidated resources. So let me use an easy example. Let's say that in one of his protests, God forbid, somebody in his organization gets arrested. You know, this happens to activists, you know, not as much these days as maybe it should, because I argue that that's, you know, we kind of lost that vein of activism, but nonetheless, they can't have an attorney on retainer. That's an insane proposition to an organization of that size, and it's just not practical. But where does that attorney come from? Because we absolutely have to have the back of someone who put themselves out there for us, because he's a public servant as well. All the people in his organization are public servants. So that's the type of resources that we need to have to really have someone back when they need us. And, you know, what I would advocate for in this organization is that one of the reasons we're so far behind as progressives, meaning that we're just getting our butts kicked all over the place with pretty much any issue you can name, most of the elected officials, you name it, and we shouldn't be. The numbers there are there to support us as progressives. But we don't have a party infrastructure that even supports us the way that it should. You know, our party structure has become very corporatized and bureaucratic, but the Republicans do. And now I'm not advocating all Republicans are the same, and I'm not saying that their party infrastructure doesn't have infighting or what have you. But whether you're a Tea Party Republican or a fiscal conservative Republican, there is a very formalized structure, and there is a network of people and a Rolodex of people that if one of their own is in trouble, they know who to call. And we don't have that. And so we can try to build up our local party structure and hope that that gets stronger. Or, you know, we can, what I'm advocating is, you know, that's great as a start, but I'm not going to wait around for our party to get it together. We as progressives need to come together as a statewide entity and hold our party's feet to the fire.
Well, can I just share my point of view on that subject?
With
that
your
you...
show, yeah.
I think that the party infrastructure, I think that the party organization doesn't have an organization. I think that a few people manage to find ways of making the party do bend to what it needs to do in order to get things done. But I think that any organization, any group of people who were able to actually come in and build a grassroots effort to accomplish some goal could walk in and take over that party infrastructure, and it's theirs for the taking, because it's right now it's under the control of a few people. But we have the rules in place that I say we, the Democratic Party structure has the rules in place. It has a couple of interesting things that are cool. One, it has national recognition across the United States, so there's no problem with ballot access. And two, it has a set of rules that enable those people who are willing to put forth the time and effort to make something in within this party organization have some effectiveness can come in and use it. It's a viable tool that right now is not being utilized. Its ineffectiveness is the result of the fact that most of the seats are empty. I don't know what your party organization looks like in your county, Shauna. But I can tell you that in Lake County, half of our precinct committee captain positions are not filled.
We have a number of positions not filled.
Anybody who wants to come in and do the organizing that it takes to build an organization within a county can virtually walk in to the Democratic Executive Committee and become the leadership just by virtue of being well organized. So the problem for us isn't that our party isn't well organized, it's that we aren't well organized in order to be able to occupy our party.
What a fantastic phrase, occupy our party. I love everything you're saying right now.
So I know that John, Shauna, I think that you and John probably have a lot of things in common in terms of the kinds of things, the vision of the future that you're working towards. And I, I think that there's a good possibility that John may be able to contribute to some of the Turn Florida Progressive efforts that you're working on in the Fort Pierce area. But I also know that John this is his movie night, and he broke away from that to do the show tonight. So I want to give you, John, the next 10 minutes to kind of focus in on whatever specific activities you're involved in that you'd like to talk about, be it the TPP or the fenced deer issue or whatever it is, and go into depth with that to the extent that you'd like to.
Okay. First, I'd like to comment. I like what Shauna was saying, basically, about the support and about protesters or whatever to get locked up. The support, I kind of see like our organization, and I would like to see like a state ride. I ain't going to say party because I don't like the word party and all that stuff, but statewide where we can coordinate with each other and maybe have quarterly get-togethers and throw ideas against each other and where when they have a statewide movement, such as they had for the, I'm sure you're familiar with the 7 days of action they were calling for out of North Carolina, Florida couldn't respond because we wasn't organized down here. But if we had some type of statewide group that can coordinate with all the different progressive groups down here and kind of support each other, I think that would be great. I know what we try to do down here, we try to reach out to a lot of the other organizations down here locally, the NAACP now and so forth, to try to coordinate and keep working together down here. And I think we need to probably do that on a state level too, which would be great. We have a lot of activities. We have an event coming up on September 29th. We have monthly events, which will be this month we're going to be talking about the prison system. We have a speaker coming from Miami, George, and I don't want to say his last name. It's kind of hard to allow. Croft. He wrote a book, Getting Away with Murder. He's going to be our speaker this month. And we normally have speakers every month or movies. We've had David Cobb down here. We had Sister Patricia Seaman from the Earth Students Prudence. And we try to get as many interesting speakers as we can. And to be nice, if we can interact with other groups and share information and share speakers.
What was the name of the book that this fellow wrote?
Getting Away with Murder.
Okay. Go ahead. I wanted to look that up.
Okay. The speaker worked in a psychiatric unit in a prison, and apparently became a whistleblower on some of the stuff that was going on there, the cover-up mentality of the Florida Department of Corrections. So he's going to talk a lot about that. And I'm hoping we can get into the privatization of the prisons, too, and discuss those type of issues as well. Our organization also is a strong supporter of Move to Amend, and I also like to mention that tomorrow night there's supposed to be, if you go to movetoamend.org, there's a debate with David Cobb and the attorney that was with Citizens United case. They're supposed to debate, so they'll be very educational. The guy's name was James Cobb, I think. He argued the Citizens United case, and David Cobb would be a debate. So that's very educational, too. If people want to go to movetoamend.org, they'll be able to probably get the link to go into that debate. Our overpass protests this month, we're doing one on the 12th of September at the Oslo Overpass, 5 to 6, we're doing PPP. Then the 26th of September, we'll be doing a Keystone overpass, Oslo, 5 to 6. November 1st, we have our March Against Corruption coming up. Our March Against Corruption, we have a couple young ladies in our organization that are very artistic, and they've been working on some of those puppets. I'm not sure if you're aware of the Backbone campaign that does a lot of those type puppets and stuff nationwide for a lot of protests. That's where they got the ideas. They have a vulture they're working on, and they're working on Scalia, our Supreme Court judge. And we're hoping to have them ready for our parade, our protests on November 1st. And a few of us are going to New York for the 21st September Climate March. That's some of the stuff we have going on. Of course, we also be attending a lot of our local city, county, commissioners' meetings and trying to stay with other progressive organizations, try to communicate with them, work together.
Wow. You know, I'm looking up the Backbone Campaign now. You just reeled off a whole list of, like, really important things. John, do you guys have a website?
Yes. Our website's TC for Treasure Coast, tcprogressivealliance.com. And our email is tcprogressivealliance@gmail.com. If anybody wants to communicate, Gmail, email.
So TC...
On our website, we try to have a happenings page, and we try to support some of the local things that's going on, whether they're river cleanups or River Coalition is doing an outstanding job down here fighting to try to clean up this river. So we try to support those efforts and post their activities on our happenings page. So if you're in the Fort Pierce area, check out our website, go to our happenings page, and try to support some of the local activities.
You know, I'm just overwhelmed with how you just, like, threw out for, like, about 2 minutes a list of things that we should be, everybody making notes of and being involved in. Are all of those listed on your website, John?
Yes, they are. Except
okay.
I don't think the move to amend one tomorrow night is probably not on our website because I just got the email on it. It's probably a little bit late now to be posting it. But if they're into us, just anybody listening, just go to movetoamend.org.
So this is an online debate that people can listen to?
Yes, and that's with covering to the amendment to the Constitution that we are pushing for, the Move to Amend is pushing for, the corporations are not people, and money is not free speech. We believe in their interpretation of the amendment.
So I'm on your website, John, and they should go to the happenings page, and they'll see all these things that you just went down the list?
Yeah, they should be listening. Yeah, just click the happenings page tab, and that will have most of the stuff that and there's probably quite a few more things on there that's happening in our community.
So we've got the Stop the Keystone Group demonstrations for, that was September 5th and 6th, so that would be over. There's protests against TPP on September 12th.
Right. Well, the September 5th was canceled because of the rain the other night, so we rescheduled it for the 26th. Probably haven't made that change on our happening page yet, but it'll be on the 26th for the Keystone.
So tonight you're watching the Disruption movie?
Yes, we are.
And next week is Social Justice Film. At the UU Church in Vero Beach?
Yes, that's a great group with a lot of social issues.
Now, what's
they
the TCPA?
Pardon?
What is the TCPA? Oh, that's the Treasure Coast Progressive Alliance. Your next board meeting is on September 16th?
Yes, that's our board
okay.
meeting.
And then you've got September 21st is the event in New York City, the Climate March.
Correct.
Okay. You guys are just doing an incredible amount of things for being. I'm just totally in awe, John, what you guys are doing.
We have a few really dedicated, really hard, dedicated people that really support all this stuff, and they give a lot. Their heart is into it. They really believe in the progressive issues and all. And, yeah, we have a strong backbone of maybe 10, 12 people that's really strong. And many of our other members also support. They come out regularly and support us in other ways. We're kind of really lucky to have these people, and we're hoping to grow, get more, and really make a difference down here. And, try to get far to be progressive and try to make a better community and world.
So I encourage everybody that's listening or that listens to the podcast to go to tcprogressivealliance.com. TC, that's Treasure Coast, progressivealliance.com. And when you get there, click on the happenings. That'll show you what the TC Progressives are up to. And John, you're welcome to stick around and, like, jump in with any thing that you'd like to share. I want to get back to Shauna here. But I also know that if you need to jump off, that you've got a movie thing going on there, and, you know, we don't want to hold you up on that. We really appreciate all of the cool stuff that you're doing down there on the Treasure Coast in Fort Pierce, and thank you very much for coming and sharing it with the PNN audience tonight.
Okay, and thank you. And if anybody out there wants to support us, they can join our group online there and support us that way, or come out to our events if you're in the area. And thank you, and I appreciate all you're doing.
And like I said, feel free to stick around and jump in. If you've got to get back to the movie, we understand. Shauna? You know, I'm just, I met you, I think, last year. Were you in Orlando at the Florida Progressive Group
yeah.
meeting? And I think you presented
yes.
the concept of turning Florida progressive at that event.
I did. And, you know, we've had a lot of successes behind the scenes, but one of the things, since I've put my mind to spending a lot of my time and energy on this project, is that it's also revealed a lot more fracture than I think I originally knew existed. As much as I felt like I was educated about Florida politics and about Florida progressives, we're just a lot more broken, I think, than I even realized going into this.
Do you want to talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, well, you know, we've touched on some of it, which is part of it is you have a lot of well-intentioned groups and individuals that once they hit a certain point, and all organizations go through this at some point, a point of transition or a point of growth, that there's just really no one to help them. And so they end up more than not disbanding or just kind of fizzling out because they can't reach that transition period alone. And it's not a fair expectation to expect them to. But part of it also is, you know, you have people that are allegedly progressive that that do find a way to a position of power or influence that are perfectly happy and satisfied with the system being broken because there's a fear there that they might get voted out or they might not be as important if they share the information that they have. And it's something that, as much as the activist community tends to be a very sharing and giving community, I'm not finding that with those people in positions of power, even progressives. Now, that's not to say everyone, and I don't want to cast all of our progressive leaders with the same brush, but, I mean, we really don't have someone that's carrying the banner that's in elected office at a statewide level or even known regionally that is saying, I'm going to put myself out there and I'm going to stand beside these communities. Far from it. What I'm finding is behind the scenes, it's a lot of resistance. You know, well, I don't want to do that because it's more difficult for me, or I don't want to take the risk, or look at stand your ground. I mean, we had national support for introducing some sort of legislation and nothing happened. So I just don't feel like there's a leadership there that we need, and nor is there an infrastructure put into place to help elect those leaders. So it becomes kind of a cycle, you know, that we need to break.
Okay, fair enough. I've got a lot of thoughts on what you just said. I'm not going to, like, jump down that rabbit hole tonight. But
I have a feeling we could do a whole show just on that.
probably. And I would like to spend some time, and I think we've talked about having a conversation online, and that's maybe one of the things that would be worth talking about. And maybe after doing that, maybe we will do a show just on that. But moving along to like another aspect of what it means to turn Florida progressive, we've got the issue that, yes, it is, there are some fractures. And I think I would kind of summarize what you just said as people tend to build fiefdoms, and then they like to protect their
absolutely.
Fiefdoms.
And
there are all sorts of reasons, some of them more well-intentioned than others. So that's an issue. It will always be an issue as long as humans are involved in these kinds of efforts. So we've got, on the one hand, we've got some fracturing issues. On the other hand, we've got a lot of good things going on with a lot of local groups that are trying to do things. And as you pointed out, and as I have believed for some time, we need to build bridges between these local organizations, and so that we can have a network that has some sharing of responsibility and has some ability to provide what I called an umbrella structure to kind of provide these resources, but which I understand has the connotation of maybe imposing upon the local organizations, which isn't really what I was thinking when I said umbrella organization. But now we got a lot of good stuff going on. How do we get from where we're at to where I think both of us think that we need to go?
Well, I think you kind of hit the nail on the head there. I mean, part of it is stuff you're already working on personally, which is promoting organizations like the Treasure Coast Progressive Alliance and sharing with people, not just so they could directly support them, but so that they could also learn from them. What are they already doing that's so successful? And that leads to another set of conversations similar to the Progressive Conference you and I have both attended, more regional events where we can have an exchange of ideas and fellowship, because we're all learning things every single day. How do we impart that wisdom to each other? Because then we all collectively tend to grow and strengthen. And then the other side of that is finding a way to really advertise the successes. You know, we do take it on chin a lot, but there's also an amazing amount of those small moments and quiet victories that just aren't being celebrated. And we need that, because we need to remind each other and also to teach this next generation of activists that's coming out of college now or graduating high school now that this method of getting active in the community does work. You know, despite the cynical news media and despite how nasty politics can be, we've also made some amazing headway over the last 40 years or so in our country's history being progressive activists. And, you know, you look at how the tide is changing on issues like LGBT and now decriminalizing marijuana usage. We're making headway. And so we've got to remind people of that so they don't abandon that model or just think, I might as well not get involved because nothing's going to work anyway.
Boy, that is certainly one of the mantras of the 44%. We talk about the one percenters and the one tenth of one percenters, and then Mitt Romney had his 7%.
Seven, yeah.
and then there, I don't know. There's everybody's got a percentage. Well, my percentage is the 44%. I think it went down to 43% after the numbers were finally said and done. And that's the number of people, eligible voters, that don't participate in the process. One of the things that occurred to me is that if we just engaged, you know, a relatively small percent of those 43% that didn't vote in 2008 and 2012, we could win every election.
Absolutely.
And so I think that's going to be the ongoing discussion. And Shauna, I wish we had more time because this has just been really fascinating. But we're getting ready to come to the end of the webcast. So I want to invite you back. And I know that you know Rick does the Sunday night show, and I'm sure he's going to have you back anyway. But I certainly would like to get you back for the next discussion to move this discussion that we've been having forward, because this is a really important one.
Well, I want to thank you so much for having me, for being, you know, a leader in the community that initiates these types of conversations. And if anyone from the Treasure Coast Progressive Alliance is still listening, I also just want to applaud them for what they're doing, because I think people take groups like that for granted, but there's a lot of hard work and sacrifice that goes into what they're doing. So I appreciate you including me in a discussion that includes people like John and Muhammad and the work that they're doing. So thank you so much.
And we'll certainly be talking and certainly be working towards the effort of turning Florida progressive in the coming days, weeks, and months. And hopefully, if we can be successful at all in this effort between now and November, we can have a new governor that's going to give us a little bit more support than we can expect out of the current one.
Absolutely. Thank you so much, and have a good evening.
All right. Thank you, Shauna, and I look forward to our next opportunity to share with our progressive community on PNN.
Absolutely.
So I accidentally hit a wrong button here, but we're getting ready to, if I can find it, we're getting ready to close out with There's a Better World Coming. Do you know, I guess everybody knows Guthrie, not Arlo, Woody Guthrie.
There's a better world that's a-coming, tell you why. There's a better world that's a-coming, tell you why. We will beat 'em on the land, on the sea, and in the sky. There's a better world that's a-coming, tell you why. There's a better world that's a-coming, don't you see. There's a better world that's a-coming, don't you see. When we'll all be union, and we'll all be free. There's a better world that's a-coming, don't you see? There's a better world.